I think that to a very large extent, if we should distinguish between the Chinese communists, that is, some of the Chinese and communists on top are very sophisticated individuals, men who have a great understanding of their own country and some understanding of the outside world. But it's my impression that some of the communists on lower levels are very doctrinaire.
That's right, yes, no doubt about it.
I would take it you both agree that the Chinese communists have not yet effectively found a way of dealing with the basic problem of taking care of the peasant that they must find if they are to remain as a government with broad peasant support. What about some of the achievements they have so far chalked up?
Well, on the purely economic side, they've restored communications with remarkable rapidity. The railroads are running again, and they're running better than they have for a good many years, to all report.
Also, I think they have established the administration in China in a form which has not been since the fall of the Manchu dynasty. That is, the nationalist government's authority in many of the outlying areas of China was limited by the willingness of the local warlords or governors to accept the instructions or the legislation passed in Chongqing or Nanking. The communists have eliminated those warlords, given a few of them jobs, but more or less paper jobs in their government, and now they have administrative control of the entire country with the exception of parts of Tibet.
In this report on communist China on the University of Chicago Roundtable, we're not discussing the question of whether the Chinese are good or bad in the new communist regime, but what they are doing in terms of meeting the problems that face them. If they have achieved these points that you have made, why? How have they done it when the nationalists apparently could not meet the same problems?
Well, it seems to me that they have first a clear-cut program, an idea of what they want to do, which the Kuomintang, I think, did not have, and it's directed around discipline, subservience of the individual to the cause, cooperative effort. They've made a tremendous stress upon certain moral qualities which are comparatively new in Chinese history and which have made a tremendous impression on many other people. They've tried to wipe out graft, and I think there is less graft there than there has been for many years in the past.
Also, I think the Chinese communists have generated a massive psychological pressure that's new to China. The individual is not forced by the police to conform. He is forced, I think it would be a sign of weakness on the part of the communists when they start using police powers extensively to deal with the population as such. They use them to deal with bandits and guerrillas and others. But the individual in the large cities, and to some extent the peasants in the countryside, are organized into social groups. And it's in order to get along in society, in order to be part of a society, the individual has to join. And he does join. He becomes caught up in this thing and organized for the ends of the communists to a large extent determined.
And there is a mass enthusiasm generated in that way.
Among certain social groups.
Yes. Labor groups, student groups, and the like.
Well, now what happens if a person who is Chinese and who lived under non-communist regime all of his life doesn't like these communists? I can't imagine that suddenly the communists come to power and everybody immediately likes them. What happens to the man who doesn't like them?
Well, a lot of them have left China, as a matter of fact, those who didn't like them.
I had it put to me very well by a young Chinese. He had come out from Shandong province, and in Shandong, before he left, he had met one of his old schoolmates, who was by now an official of the communist government and had graduated from several of the communist training schools. He and his old schoolmate, who was now a communist, had had a series of long discussions, the result of which was the communist friend told him, he said, either you've got to join us or you've got to get out. If you're going to stay around here, you'll have to join us. There's no other way you can survive in the future. That, I think, is essentially true as regards the young students, as regards the literate population. As regards the old people, they can more or less retire and sit by the wayside and watch things. But the young people are forced, if they want to go along, to join up in this thing because there's nothing else for them to do.
In other words, society is consciously being reorganized so that the old bases of power no longer exist, and so that in order to get on, get along with other people, and to get food and to get work, individual Chinese must go along with the communist regime. Is that
right? He has no choice at the present time, unless he's willing to go out into the countryside and become a bandit or a guerrilla. And that's happened only in far west China and far south China on an extensive basis.
Well, now these revolutionary urges, which existed in China, as you say, have existed for a long time, also exist in other countries in Asia. That is the dynamic of Asia today. The communists have one solution. In the parts of Asia that I know anything about, I'm convinced that the communist solution is not the only solution, that there are other solutions as well.
Well, Talbot, I think that we give the Chinese communists too much credit if we assign them the role of having created this Chinese revolution. I'd say rather that the Chinese communists moved over and have taken over management of the revolution. They are now directing its course. They are now training the people who are going to shape the new government and the new society that they're creating. But it's part of an enormous social upheaval that is affecting not only the political and economic structure of the society, but that is affecting the structure of the family, that's tearing apart the old human relationships, that is knocking to pieces the old conception of faith. The communists are in control of it now, but they didn't create it initially.
No. It goes back long before the communists, but they have given it a conscious direction and a dynamic force, which it lacked before, I believe.
The force includes, does it not, a very strong army?
I think that the army at the present time serves certain functions inside of China, but it has to be considered in a different context. That is, the Chinese Communist Army today is either the largest, or next after the Russian, the second largest standing army in the world. The frontline Chinese Communist troops today number about 2,400,000. In addition to that, they have roughly 2,700,000 second-line or military district troops. To get an idea of the Chinese Communist military machine today, you'd have to take what we have been fighting in North Korea and multiply it by at least 20. It'll give you some picture of what we'd be up against if we come into war with the Chinese Communists.
Well, what does this all add up to, these mistakes, these basic difficulties that the regime faces, its successes, and its power potential?
It adds up to the fact that the communists are there and are going to be there for a long time to come, and we have to recognize that fact and plan our course accordingly.
It adds up to the fact also, I believe, that in Asia, if we're going to be on the Asian continent, we can survive only by using our wits. That is, we can use military force in certain situations wherever we have the capability of doing so, but we also have to use all of the techniques of diplomacy, the techniques of propaganda, to an extent that we have not used them up until the present time.
And we have to understand their psychology to a much greater degree, I think, than we have in the past.
Well, I think the direct question to that is, to what extent are the Chinese communists controlled by Moscow?
Well, that's a matter which differs according to their internal domestic program and their foreign program. They developed in China for a long time before they came into complete power of the country. They worked out solutions according to the local situation. In planning those solutions, they were influenced comparatively little, very little, I would say, from by Moscow. But now they're in control of the entire country. They're in face-to-face with the question of foreign relations, which are new to them. And in that sphere of foreign relations, they pretty much follow the Russian line.
It's my impression that for a great number of the Chinese communists, Moscow, so to speak, is the holy city. And what comes out from there is taken at face value. At least that was true. It may be that it's now changing.
May I say on that also that there are large numbers of non-communist Chinese, of course, who are very doubtful about this alignment in foreign affairs with Moscow, who don't like it. That is the weak point, I would say, in the Chinese communist setup.
Also, the Russians at the present time, it's my impression, are making very determined and, to some extent, realistic efforts to influence the state of affairs in China. That is, the Russians, wherever possible, are furthering the interests of particular Chinese communists who see the development of communism in China in essentially the same terms as the Russians see it.
Well, the thing that I still am concerned about is the problem of how much control in the interior of China, in the internal government, there is from Russia. Is this going to be a revolution in which Russians can continue to have major influence?
I think that Russia's influence will depend upon several factors. One, the success and the skill with which they play their cards and use their opportunities. Two, the extent to which China does or does not become associated with other countries aside from Russia. At the present time, the Indians, for example, are making an extensive effort to bring the Chinese communists into realization of the fact that they have some community of interest with the rest of Asia.
I think it would be a profound mistake in that connection to lump China together with the little countries of Eastern Europe. The situation is very different in China from those countries.
In other words, China is not a satellite,
I wouldn't consider it so. They cooperate with Russia because, on the whole, they want to cooperate.
Also, I think we have to remember and think of what China was at the height of the previous dynasties, when countries such as Korea, Vietnam, parts of Burma, parts of Indonesia were tribute-bearing states. The French got the province of Tonkin in northern Indochina only after defeating the Chinese in the War of 1884.
That's the thing that strikes me, that the whole balance of power in Asia is changed by the emergence of a strong China after many years when there has been a very weak China indeed. Today we have news that the French are withdrawing from the northernmost posts of Indochina and that Ho Chi Minh's group is taking over up there. The influence of the Chinese Revolution on the revolutions of these neighboring areas, I think, is very, very important. It is a measure of the problem now facing the United States, I think, that communist China has developed to the extent that it has. And I take it you gentlemen agree that communist China can only be dealt with today as a major power in Asia and perhaps a major power in the world.
Thank you, gentlemen. Taking part in today's University of Chicago Roundtable on Report on Communist China, fifth in a series on the problems of Asia, were Albert Ravenholt, Far Eastern correspondent, Chicago Daily News, Dirk Bada, Far Eastern expert, University of Pennsylvania, and Phillips Talbot, senior associate of the Institute of Current World Affairs. The printed pamphlet of today's roundtable discussion of Report on Communist China contains the full text of the discussion and the supplementary articles, reading lists, and materials on Communist China. Be sure to write to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, to secure your copy of today's pamphlet. Single copies are 10 cents in coin. A full year subscription to the Roundtable pamphlet costs only $3. Enclose $3 with your order and make your subscription begin with today's program on Report on Communist China. I'll repeat the address, the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Next week, the Roundtable continues its series on problems of Asia with a discussion of the Point 4 program in Asia. Be sure to hear this important discussion. May we invite you to join in the new Roundtable Home Study course on human rights. This course is open to all. You may enroll and begin at any time. Write the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, for the brochure describing the course and telling how you may register. Each month, a 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica is awarded to that student who most successfully completes the course that month. Today's program originated in Radio City, New York. The Roundtable is directed by George E. Probst and is a public service presentation by NBC. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.